It's time for us to begin. If you would please open your Bibles to 2 Kings chapter 15. 2 Kings chapter 15. We're going to pick up there with a name and then pursue just a little farther in our study this evening as we talk about the fall of the northern 10 tribes. Warning after warning after warning was given to them. They wouldn't listen. They wouldn't heed the warnings. They suffered oppression time and time and time again. The intent was to cause them to turn, and they would not. And so consequently, God was finally fed up with them, and the things that He had threatened, He made good on. And we see that to be the pattern, a very consistent pattern, in our study of Old Testament history. So if you would please, in 2 Kings chapter 15, I have verse 30 on the board. We're actually going to begin in verse 31, and verse 29, just before that, and then move forward just a little bit. In our studies, as we have talked about these kings, there's an obvious reason why we're studying about the kings in this Old Testament portion of Bible history. We know that these things were written, the New Testament writer says, for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages are come. In First Corinthians chapter 10, we know that they're written for our example, for our learning. And so as we study these things, let's keep in mind that they're not there just as interesting stories. They're not there just simply to give us historical facts, but they're there to give us warnings that we might learn the lessons from these and not make the same mistakes that they made. Now, we've been talking about the lineage of the kings in the history of Israel. We've talked about King Uzziah in the southern kingdom of Judah. And we noted that during King Uzziah's reign, there were several men that decided they wanted to be king. And so they made a conspiracy against the man that was king and killed him, and they became the king. And we see that to be the case of the king that we're reading about in 2 Kings chapter 15 in verse 29. It says, "In the days of Pekah, king of Israel, came Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and took Ion and Abel-Beth-Maacah and Noah and Kadesh and Hazor and Gilead and Galilee, and all the land of Naphtali, and he carried them captive to Assyria." Now, the point that we want to emphasize at this point is the point that we were leaving off with in our study last Sunday morning, that Tiglath-Pileser, the king of the Assyrian Empire, is on the rise, and he's conquering everything in his path. And he's on the horizon, being a threat to the northern kingdom of Israel, and poses himself as a threat to the southern kingdom of Judah during the reign of King Hezekiah. Now, I don't know if we'll get that far in our study tonight, but as we talk about Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and his conquering of the northern 10 tribes, we know in verse 30 it tells us, "And Hoshea, the son of Elah, made a conspiracy against Pekah, the son of Remaliah, and smote him and slew him and reigned in his stead in the 20th year of Jotham, the son of Uzziah." Now, again, I hope all of you brought your lesson books, because these charts that you see on these pages, 106 through 114, I've said this many times, they're the best, most concise concerning the most information of any charts on the kings that I've studied. And there are a number of charts that you can find. But this is an excellent study as far as these charts are concerned, because it tells you when the southern king was reigning, when the northern king became king, and vice versa. It tells us who the prophets were during that era of time, and who the enemy kings were during that era of time that present a threat either to Israel or to Judah or essentially to both. And so please study those passages that are listed on that chart and notice the timeliness of their reign on the chart. Okay? And that'll keep you current. It'll keep you studying the material from the Chronicles and the Kings that you need to be familiar with, that you need to be reading. I can't impress upon you enough the importance of that. So you get your lesson book out, lay it down beside your Bible, read the passages, and know what period of time the passages are describing. Okay? Now, having said that, we know that Hoshea became king in the 20th year of Jotham, the son of Uzziah. It says, the rest of the acts of Pekah and all that he did, behold, they are written in the book of the Chronicles of Kings of Israel. Now, how did Pekah get to be king?
He killed the guy before him.
He did. He killed the guy before him. And how did the guy before him get to be king? Okay, well actually, Menahem, he died of a natural death, and his son Pekahiah became king, but then Pekah killed Pekahiah in a conspiracy, and he became king, and then he was king for 20 years. And Hoshea then became king, and during the reign of Hoshea, question, wicked king or bad king?
Wicked or bad.
Well, Hoshea just really messed up all the way around. He was a wicked king, but not as bad as some that had been his predecessors. Probably should have already hit this button, but this gives you the line of the kings, and particularly the one that we're talking about where we are in our study. But for our study tonight, we know in chapter 17, and we're going to skip through chapter 16, because chapter 16 discusses the reign of Ahaz, king of Judah. And we've talked about Ahaz, king of Judah. So we've already looked at these verses. By the way, just on a side note, completely different from anything we've talked about. John, let me get this out or I'll forget it. We know that in verse 6 of chapter 16, you'll note that it tells us that at that time, Rezin, king of Syria, recovered Elah to Syria and drove the Jews from Elath and the, I'm sorry, I pronounced that incorrectly, Elath drove the Jews from Elath, and the Syrians came to Elath and dwelt there to this day. The first time that the Israelites are called Jews is in this passage. So sooner or later you're going to be wanting that information regarding where did that name come from. Came from right here. We can talk about the why later. But John, go ahead.
So 2 Kings 15:30 says basically Hoshea killed King the 20th year of John. In our lesson book, it's got him becoming king in the 12th year of Ahaz.
Okay. Seems like I noticed that, and I'm not sure why that's true. I'll have to resolve that. I did notice that, but I don't remember what I determined about that. Yeah, 12th year of Ahaz. Yeah. Let me work on that, because that is a discrepancy between our book and what the text says. And I've noticed one or two more of those, but I'll have to work on that.
Mickey, was that because of the joint reign sometimes they had as co-regents?
It's possible. I don't know. I'm going to make myself a note. 2 Kings.
The show is between Jotham and Uzziah, right?
Yes.
But it's got Hoshea and Ahaz, which was after Jotham.
Right.
After Ahaz.
Right.
Right. In the lesson book.
Right. That's 15. That's verse 30. Okay. I'll look into that, see if I can come up with something that might explain it. Good observation. But when Hoshea became king, we asked the question, Carolyn answered correctly, good king or bad? He was good, wicked, but not as bad as some that had been his predecessors. One of the things we want to notice in the 17th chapter, and let's pick up the reading there. Richard, you feel like reading some for me?
Sure.
Begin in verse 1 of chapter 17 and read down through verse 5, please.
2 Kings 17:1-5.
Mm-hmm.
In the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, began Hoshea, the son of Elah, to reign in Samaria over Israel, and reigned 9 years. And he did that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah, yet not as the kings of Israel that were before him. Against him came up Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, and Hoshea became his servant and brought him tribute. And the king of Assyria found conspiracy in Hoshea, for he had sent messengers to So, king of Egypt, and offered no tribute to the king of Assyria, as he had done year by year. Therefore the king of Assyria shut him up and bound him in prison. And the king of Assyria came up through all the land and went up to Samaria and besieged it 3 years.
All right. Verse 1, John chapter 17, is applicable to your question as well. No doubt where our author got his numbers, but I'll work on that some more. But to get back to the history of the thing, we note that he did evil, but not as evil as some before. In verse 3, Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up to find that Hoshea, though he had agreed to pay tribute. Now, we've talked about that already, and we talked about that during the reign of Ahaz, how that they were to pay tribute to the king of Assyria, in essence, to say, leave us alone. We'll pay you to leave us alone. But Hoshea, when it's time to pay the tribute, he doesn't want to pay the tribute. But instead, he's made some kind of an ally out of So, king of Egypt, to... would appear to fight off the Assyrians when they come to form this alliance. And what had God said to them about making alliances with Egypt or going back to Egypt? That's a no-no. Don't do that. But that's what he did. And so what we have learned is these kings that we've been discussing, they often just blatantly do the very thing that God said not to do, as if there's not going to be any consequence to that. And there were consequences to that. So what Hoshea begins is a new dynasty, a dynasty of rebellion and disobedience, not only against God, but rebellion and disobedience against alliances that have already been established with the king of Assyria. Now you'll note in verse 5, as Richard read, the king of Assyria came up throughout all the land and went up to Samaria and besieged it 3 years. Now, we've talked about a common tactic in warfare back then to take a nation or to take a city, is you throw a wall of an army around the walled city and starve them out. And that's what they did. They besieged the city of Samaria. And it tells us they did so for 3 years. How long do you think Lancaster would last with an enemy army around it and you couldn't go anywhere? Nobody could come in.
About 20 minutes.
Yeah, there'd be a rage on the grocery stores and what food was available. What would people do? And you can picture the mob setting. Everybody becomes selfish and not working together and creates turmoil within the city. And that's not uncommon. And essentially, that's what they would do then. And we've talked about in times gone by how that they, and Uzziah, as you recall, had engineers that built engines, catapults, that were useful for casting arrows and casting rocks into cities that they would conquer. And we've talked about before how that they would sometimes take a diseased body or more, and cast them into a city and spread disease within the city. What do you think we would look like? What do you think a city like Los Angeles or a large city would look like if you had that kind of thing going on and an enemy army surrounding it where you couldn't get any help? Yeah, it'd just be awful. Before long, the citizens would turn on themselves and you've just got a mess. And here's what you've got in Samaria as Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, besieges the city, and he does so for 3 years. Now you'll note beginning at verse 6, it says, in the ninth year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away unto Assyria and placed them in Hala and on the Habor, and the river, rather, of Gozan in the land of the cities of the Medes. Now, again, we've noticed that that was not an uncommon practice. One of the things you might note in your reading about the fall of Samaria, though the text tells us that the king of Assyria took Samaria. I think history records that Sargon, the king of Assyria, actually conquered the city. It was begun by Shalmaneser, but Sargon was the fellow that inherited this battle and eventually caused the demise of the northern 10 tribes as the city of Samaria fell and Israel succumbed to the onslaught of the Assyrians. Any questions or comments just here? One of the things we want to say in observation is what the Assyrians did. They stand out, I suppose, among enemies of the people of God for their cruelty. They would not only kill folks as they conquered a place, but anybody who was left, they would displace, especially if that person had any power, money, ability, position. And what was the purpose of that?
To destroy the government.
Destroy the government, that's right. That would prevent any possibility of any leadership rising to the top, and so of course they would prevent then any kind of future rebellion by doing that. Now, in our studies in the past, we've mentioned that Isaiah and Hosea were prophets during this time. Isaiah prophesied in Isaiah chapter 10. Now, I want you to remember this. If you're taking notes, you write this down. Isaiah chapter 10. In Isaiah chapter 10, now when we think of the book of Isaiah, what do you think about? What was the theme of his prophecies?
Christ.
Of Christ. We call Isaiah the messianic prophet. That's right. When we look in Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14, we read of his virgin birth. We look in Isaiah chapter 9, we see prophecy regarding his reign as king. The child would be born, but he would sit upon the throne of David. When we look especially at Isaiah chapter 53, as we've heard read many, many times, we see a very graphic description of the crucifixion of the Lord. But one of the elements that sometimes we fail to see is the text of Isaiah 9 and 10, where Isaiah the prophet is prophesying concerning the attitude that God has toward these people, though they have rebelled against him, and how he intends to discipline them or punish them for their rebellion. We did read in our last study, I believe, Sunday morning, from verses 8, 9, and 10, the attitude of the people, where specifically in verse 10, it tells us that the inhabitants of Samaria were proud and stubborn in their heart. Verse 10 said, the bricks are fallen, but we will build with hewn stone. The sycamores are cut down, but we will put cedars in their place. What does that suggest to us?
Verse
10 of chapter 9, Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 9, verse 10. The bricks are fallen, but we'll build with hewn stone. Which is better, bricks or hewn stone?
I actually looked that up because I wasn't sure. The hewn stone is better. That's what they made the rich people's houses out of. And then the cedars are better than the sycamores. And so they're saying, well, it doesn't matter what happens. This is Peshaw. We're going to build better. We're going to make this better on our own. It doesn't matter what happens.
That's right.
We'll replace it with better stuff.
That's right. That's kind of flippant, arrogant attitude, isn't it? And that's the attitude that they had. Exactly right. Very good. You looked that up. Very good. And that's right on target. So we're going to make it better. It doesn't matter what God does. We're going to make it better. John?
Oh, I'm talking. I got to stop.
Oh.
2 Kings 15:30.
Pardon me?
2 Kings 15:30.
Okay.
That word that's 20th is Esra. And I don't understand how they do the numbers, but in some places it's 20th. Other places it's translated 28th, 21st, 24th, 25th. And if you do the math, I mean, Ahaz was reigning, but it was 28 years after God took over, so maybe he just didn't recognize Ahaz because he wasn't a good king.
Well, that's possible. That's possible. You were distracted, weren't you?
I was a little.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, hold that thought. I'll give that a lot of thought. But as we look back over here at Isaiah chapter 9, in verse 12, continue reading there. Isaiah 9, verse 12. It says the Syrians before and the Philistines behind, and they shall devour Israel with open mouth. For all this his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. Two thoughts on that, and you can think about this and figure out which one you think is the most acceptable. Some have suggested that this expression, his hand is stretched out still, indicates that God's anger is not satisfied. Others have taken the position that his hand is stretched out still, that in spite of their rebellion, he continues to hold outstretched hand, offering forgiveness if they'll turn. I've in times past taken the latter of those two positions and not heard the former until recently, but both have some credibility. And both certainly could be considered correct as far as the history is concerned. But when you look at verse 12, you drop down just a little bit farther to verse 16. It says, "For they that lead this people cause them to err, and they that are led of them are destroyed." Now that's consistent with what the prophet Jeremiah said concerning the fall of Judah. As the prophet Jeremiah appealed to them to return to the old paths, what they say?
We will not.
Won't do. So we see this staunch attitude of rebellion. And the prophets were telling them, peace, peace, when there is no peace. And if you follow Jeremiah's thought over to chapter 23 of the book of Jeremiah, God is very angry with those false prophets because he said, you cause my people to err. Now one of the things I want to call to your attention just here is when error is taught, people often believe the error that they're taught and pursue that direction. And let me just offer a case in point. One that's perhaps more recent in our history. When error is taught regarding the subject of divorce and remarriage, we see in our society that divorce and remarriage is very popular. And anything that becomes popular in the society that we live in, ultimately God's people are going to have it to deal with. You just take note of that. But being as divorce and remarriage is so popular in the society in which we live, we find that there are those among God's people that want to make that easy. Get a divorce, remarry, everything's fine. All the way from denying that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are a part of the gospel, that you're not really under Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. That's part of the Old Testament. You see, now if we can get rid of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and make that a part of the Old Covenant, what have we done with Matthew 19:9? You see, it's no longer applicable. That was part of the Old Testament. So it doesn't apply to you. So as far as divorce and remarriage is concerned, the resultant adultery that Jesus was talking about, well, that was under the Old Covenant. They don't have any application to you. So do we see how that some have become accommodative to the error that people want to practice? Others say, well, you know, when you are married and divorced from everything, from bad breath to burn biscuits, and then you are baptized, that sanctifies where you are. You just start where you are, and you say, well, I won't do this anymore, and you just keep the one you've got. Well, now, I don't want to get off the subject just here, but some years ago, a friend of mine said that if a man can shuck off his wives as many times as he wants to before he's baptized, and then he's locked in with the one he's got at the point when he's baptized, he might be a little bit slow about being baptized because he might not be done shucking. And I think that's right. That's just the way that is. You see, you want to be sure you've got the one you want to keep for the rest of your life, and then when you're baptized, you're stuck, so to speak. Well, that doesn't. But do you see how that would be accommodative to the thinking of the society that we live in and then folks who want to become Christians? Now, if you think that's not so, I can point you to a number of churches where that's created problems, and what you have is adulterers within a congregation where the male may be waiting on the Lord's table, leading the table or leading the prayer, and you have people in the congregation that believe that that's sinful. And they won't stand at the table with him because they believe he's an adulterer. They lead their own prayer rather than listen to what he has to say because they believe he's an adulterer and his prayer doesn't get any higher than the ceiling. Now, I want to suggest to you that you've got division in a congregation like that. What caused it? Preachers and elders saying it's okay. Now, that's what you've got in Old Testament history when you've got prophets that say, peace, peace, when there is no peace. They're not calling upon the people to repent. They're telling the people, everything's all right, you're okay, and I urge you to turn over to Jeremiah 23 because his words are very graphic and I can't put them any better. Jeremiah chapter 23, look if you will please, and John, I've become distracted. Jeremiah chapter 23, the verse is 17. Where these false prophets, it says, they say continually unto them that despise me, Jehovah has said, ye shall have peace, but unto every one that walketh in the stubbornness of his own heart, they say, no evil shall come upon you. Well, isn't that exactly what we've got? You can do anything you want to. Marriage, divorce, don't make any difference. Remarry. You can do what you want to, and there won't be any consequences. And those of you who are young people that have not yet married, you take note of that, okay? And if somebody wants to sell you a bill of goods that it really doesn't matter, baptism takes care of it all, you come talk to me, okay? Because that's not so. And that's not hard to prove. Okay? Then there are those who want to say, well, you know, the gospel's just not applicable to the fellow who's not a Christian. If you're not a Christian, you're not bound by that. Well, if you're not bound by that, then why repent of anything? You see, he wouldn't be bound by it. Lots of stuff to consider in that. But, John, I've got to get back on the subject. When we get back over here to the text of Isaiah chapter 9. Isaiah chapter 9. Lost my place, sorry. Isaiah chapter 9. You'll note again in verse 17. It says, therefore the Lord will not rejoice over their young men, neither will he have compassion on their fatherless and widows, for everyone is profane and an evildoer, and every mouth speaketh folly. For all this his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. And you see that same statement in verse 21, for all this his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. There's always a place when you turn around, you can avoid the wrath of God, but it requires your repentance. Just saying, peace, peace, don't remove consequences. And we need to see that. Any questions or comments about that? I've got another point while we're in Isaiah.
Yes.
He turned, but even the prodigal son didn't get his inheritance back.
No.
It was gone forever. Okay. Now, while we are open there to the opening of Isaiah 9, drop down into chapter 10. We've looked at this. It says, ho, Assyrian, the rod of mine anger, the staff in whose hand is mine indignation. Now we'll see in the next verse, he said, I will send him against a profane nation, and against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge to take the spoil and to take the prey, and to tread them down like the mire of the streets. Howbeit he meaneth not so, neither doth his heart think so. But it shall be in his heart to destroy and to cut off nations, not a few. The king of Assyria would have no intention of serving God. But God would use him just the same to accomplish his end. Now, in the latter part of this, the next paragraph, beginning in verse 12, we note that God has a plan for the king of Assyria, who has an arrogant attitude that he did all this himself, and he's going to bring him down. And it's about that point in time when the book of Habakkuk is written. And Habakkuk is concerned about the southern kingdom of Judah, about their idolatry and rebellion against God, somewhat later from where we're studying now in our text of 2 Kings. And Habakkuk's concern is, God, how long are you going to tolerate this among your people? And what did God tell Habakkuk? That was me. Perhaps that was me. What did God tell Habakkuk? That's right. Don't worry about it. I've got it all under control. I've got a plan, and I'll take care of it. But what was the plan? When Habakkuk was told, God told him before he told him, he said, you won't believe it if I tell you. And indeed, when God told him, Habakkuk didn't believe it. What was the plan of God? What was he going to do to the people of Judah?
Raise up the Chaldeans.
Yeah. And Habakkuk was appalled. They're worse than we are. How can you use them against your people? God said, I've got a plan for that too. What was going to happen to the Chaldeans? That's right. They were going to be overthrown by the Medes and the Persians. And God even named the name of the man who would eventually become the king of the Medo-Persian Empire that would write a decree allowing these of the people of God who had been taken captive to go home and rebuild the city of Jerusalem. Now, the name of the man was given, by the way, by Isaiah, chapter 44 and 45, about 200 years before that man was ever born, much less before his kingdom was established. Now, you talk about impressive. We need to be impressed with that. But look at the people during the time of Hoshea. We know in verse 7 it says, chapter 17, 2 Kings 17, verse 7, it was so because the children of Israel had sinned against Jehovah their God, who brought them up out of the land of Egypt from under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and had feared other gods and walked in the statutes of the nations whom Jehovah cast out from before the children of Israel and of the kings of Israel which they made. And the children of Israel did secretly the things that were not right against Jehovah their God, and they built them high places in all their cities, from the tower of the watchman to the fortified city, and they set them up pillars and asherim upon every high hill and under every green tree, and there they burnt incense in all the high places, as did the nations whom Jehovah carried away before them, and they wrought wicked things to provoke Jehovah to anger. Now, did you notice? I tried to emphasize that. As did the nations before them. They're doing the very same thing the nations before them did. What did God do with those nations?
They carried them away.
That's right. It was the Israelites who were then the instruments of God's wrath against these people. And now, lo and behold, the Israelites are doing exactly the same thing. What do they expect God to do? You remember back when he was speaking to Abraham? Genesis chapter 15, I believe it is. And Abraham was in the land, and he raised the question, how do I know that this is going to be my land? God said, well, that's going to be 400 years down the pipe. Your descendants, fourth generation, are going to come in and take the land. And the reason why is the wickedness of the Amorites is not yet full. Remember that. Because we surely well know that later on the wickedness of the Amorites became full, and God brought in the Israelites and started to say whooped up on them, but conquered them. All right, David?
My question is almost like metaphysical. I don't know what else to call it, because God, the prophets prophesied, and God said 200, 400, 1,000 years in advance. And yet, at the same time, if you turn from your sins, you'll be blessed. If you don't, you'll be cursed. So, somewhere between choice but do they have a role to play out, or do they still have choice?
Oh, they had choice all the way through.
And those people that were prophesied still would have been born.
Yes.
But
yes.
Would have created maybe a little different scenario.
Yes. Now, that's an interesting point. We see all along the way of this what would appear to be an upset to the plan of God from Genesis 3:15 relative to the scheme of redemption. And we saw it almost come to pass during the days of young Joash, when the lineage of David had all but been cut off. But we find that Jehoiada the priest saved that young baby, and when he was 8 years old, declared him to be king. And now we've got things right back on track. Satan didn't win that battle. In fact, he didn't win any. Every time he tried to upset the plan of God, all through this period of history, he may have come close a time or two, but close don't count. You see, that don't work. Now, going back to our text, look, if you will, please, at verse 13. Now, we've read what they were doing. Just to characterize it once more, they're practicing the same things that the nations in the land were practicing before they drove them out. They're worshiping idols. Now, look at the attitude of God in verse 12. It says, they served idols whereof God had said unto them, ye shall not do this thing. Yet Jehovah testified unto Israel and unto Judah by every prophet and every seer, saying, turn ye from your evil ways and keep my commandments and my statutes according to all the law which I commanded your fathers and which I sent to you by my servants, the prophets. Hold that thought. What was it that God was trying, even during this time of rebellion, over and over and over, to get them to do? Keep His commandment. Get them to repent. But they, in verse 14, it says, notwithstanding, they would not hear, but hardened their neck, like to the neck of their fathers, who believed not in Jehovah their God, and they rejected His statutes and His covenants that He made with their fathers, and His testimonies which He testified unto them. And they followed vanity and became vain and went after the nations that were round about them, concerning whom Jehovah had charged them that they should not do like them. And they forsook all the commandments of Jehovah their God and made them molten images, even two calves, and made Asherah and worshipped all the host of heaven and served Baal, and they caused their sons and their daughters to pass through the fire. What's that? Molech. And used divination and enchantments, and sold themselves to do that which was evil. We saw that back with Ahab in 1 Kings 21, in the sight of Jehovah to provoke him to anger. Therefore, there's our word. What do you know is coming when you see that word? A conclusion. Therefore, Jehovah was very angry with Israel and removed them out of His sight. There was none left but the tribe of Judah only. Now, was that news to these people? Was it a shock and amazement? Well, God's not happy with us. Duh, we're worshiping idols. What had been said time and time and time and time before that God would do it? When you worship idols. That's right. He'll destroy you. Now here's where it is beginning to come to pass. I want to pass beyond that. Israel is finished indeed. Samaria is besieged. Foreigners brought in. I'm not ready to talk about that. So we'll hold that for just a moment. Look at the will, verse 19. It says, also Judah kept not the commandment of Jehovah their God, but walked in the statutes of Israel, which they made, and Jehovah rejected all the seed of Israel, and afflicted them, and delivered them into the hand of the spoilers, until He had cast them out of His sight. And we're going to see how that came to pass. But in verse 23 it tells us, until Jehovah removed Israel out of His sight, as He spake by all His servants, the prophets. So Israel was carried away out of their own land to Assyria unto this day. And we read about those who had been made captives by Assyria in times gone by. They're beginning in verse 24. And as we've noted, the people of Assyria, it was their desire to mix up people that they had conquered. So those that have been conquered, men from Babylon and from Cutta and from Ava and from Hamath and Sepharvaim and places that they had conquered, they're brought now into Israel, and in particular the city of Samaria. And what do they find when they get there?
Lions.
Lions? Indeed. And what are the lions doing to them?
Eating
them. And in their foolish, idolatrous ways, how do they explain we're being eaten of the lions in this strange new land?
We don't know the God of this area.
We don't know the God of this area. So because we don't know the God of this area, he sent lions to eat us. So what do we need? No, not yet. We need to be educated. That's almost true, Ruth. We need another God. We need to be educated about the God of this land. All right? So who do you find to educate the people who are now living in the land of Israel?
Priests that they carried away from Samaria.
Priests. Now that would be logical, wouldn't it? You take a priest who is supposed to know about the God of this land that we have taken and carried away captive. We'll bring him back and he can educate these people. And they'll know then about the God of this land, so the lions won't eat them. Now, don't that sound reasonable? That's exactly what you'd think of, isn't it, John? Well, look at it. It says, so one of the priests, verse 28, whom they had carried away from Samaria came and dwelt in Bethel and taught them how they should fear Jehovah. Sounds serious, doesn't it? Verse 29. Howbeit every nation made gods of their own and put them in the houses of the high places which the Samaritans had made. Every nation in the cities which they are wherein they dwell. And the men of Babylon made Succoth-Benoth, and the men of Puth made Nergo, and the men of Hamath made Shema, and the Avites made, and you can read the rest of that. That's enough effort on my part. Verse 32. So they feared Jehovah. And made unto them from among themselves priests of the high places, who sacrificed for them in the houses of the high places. They feared Jehovah and served their own gods after the manner of the nations from among whom they had been carried away. Let me ask you one. If you truly understand who God is, how in the world can you worship all these other gods too?
We do it today.
We try, don't we?
We do. I mean, there's a bunch of other things that go on that we allow to take the place of God in
some
ways. So.
And what does that suggest to us about our service to God? We're really not serious about it. No, we're really not serious about it. Now, question. Why was the northern 10 tribes of Israel, why were they taken captive? What had God threatened them all along? What was the purpose? Why had they been taken captive? If you do what?
If they turn their back on God, I'm guilty of idolatry.
That's right. If you worship and serve other gods, I'll take you captive. What about this priest now that's been taken captive? What's he know about worshiping God?
He doesn't.
But he's come back to educate these folks, yes.
Interesting thing to notice is that Jeroboam, when he set up the northern kingdom, set up another tribe of priests that were not from Levi. So this priest not only was not the right person to teach them, he wasn't even a Levite.
Yeah. So what's he know? But he's teaching them about God. Oh, yeah. So they can fear God. All this other stuff. But look at the reactions. Says they feared God, but they served right along with their other gods. What have they done, Bruce? This is what you said, God. Well, they just added another to the list. You see?
And when the blind lead the blind, both of them.
That's right. And that's what's taking place. You've just added another god to the list that these who are now the inhabitants of the northern portion are worshiping. And if you look at verse 34, it says, unto this day, they do after their former manner. They fear not Jehovah, neither do they after their statutes or after their ordinances or after the law or after the commandment which Jehovah commanded the children of Jacob, whom he named Israel. He told them, don't worship other gods. Keep yourselves pure. Worship me and only me. If you don't, I'll destroy you. And look at what they're doing. Look at verse 40. It says, howbeit they did not hearken, but they did after their former manner. So these nations feared Jehovah and served their graven images, their children likewise, and their children's children, as they, or as did their fathers, so do they unto this day. Now, what's changed? Nothing. Now, interestingly enough, have I got about 4 minutes or so?
You do.
All right.
What is it? They feared God, so they were afraid of God, and yet they still continued with all these other idols.
They feared God like they feared their own gods.
I'm starting to Jeroboam. What Jeroboam offered was the path of least resistance to evil.
Well, that's right. He gave them the privilege to do what they wanted to. That's right.
Yeah, well, why bother yourself so they not know it?
Yeah. You know? And that's idolatry. You create the God, the will of the God is yours. You do what you want to.
You don't even have to travel very far.
That's right. Now, I want to tie something together with our text of 1 or 2 Kings 17. Follow me on this. It's very important, I believe. When you come into John chapter 4 in the New Testament, and you read about Jesus and the Samaritan woman. There was a lot of time that passed. I didn't get this point. I kind of stumbled upon it. But in John chapter 4, you think that, well, the Samaritans worshiped in this mount, that is, in Mount Gerizim. And you would think that the Samaritans worshiped God. That's the impression you get from this Samaritan woman. But if you drop down in the text to verse 20, now, this is after Jesus has told her that the man she's married to is not her husband. She's had 5 husbands, etc. And she perceives that he is a prophet. You see that in verse 19. Now, in verse 20, it says, "Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and ye say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. Jesus said unto her, Woman, believe me, the hour cometh, when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem shall ye worship the Father." Lots to be said on that, but I don't have time. Verse 22. He said, "Ye worship that which ye know not. We worship that which we know, for salvation is from the Jews." Now, don't miss that point. Years had passed since 2 Kings 17. We're now into the New Testament, and we know that the intertestamental period was about 400 years. A lot of years have passed since 2 Kings 17. But when Jesus said to this Samaritan woman, "Ye worship that which ye know not," what had the Samaritans known about God from their conception, from their beginning?
Not very much.
Not very much, no. Not very much. So when Jesus said to this Samaritan woman, "Ye worship that which ye know not," well, the reason is the history of the Samaritans was not founded upon a knowledge of God. Their perception of God is he's like one of all the others. And indeed, they built a temple in Mount Gerizim to worship God. But you see, he was not distinct among the Samaritans. He was just another. All right, Jenny?
I have a question back in 2 Kings 17 about the practices of Assyria when taking over a city. Says that the king of Assyria brought in all of these people to the area, and I know that that takes them out of their circles of influence, and so makes it more difficult for them to do some sort of upkeep. But is it likely that it also created kind of a tower of battle scenario where everybody's got different languages also?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Somebody has said that if you want to completely defeat a people, you take away from them their identity. You take away from them their identity as a nation. You take away their language. You take away their gods. You take away their culture, their practices. And, yeah. I think that's right.